Hey, ladies and gentlemen, hope you're doing well. Thank you so much for tuning in. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. And today we have an interview that I recorded a few days ago here with John Bruce Leonard. He's the editor-in-chief of Arctos, and we're going to be talking about the situation in Italy specifically. He is located in Italy, and he has a lot of information to share with us about Matteo Salvini and how he is transforming Italy from the inside. A lot of positive aspects of what's happening in the country right now. And we'll be diving into that and much more here today with our guests. So I hope you enjoy. Great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Henrik, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. I was on Internegrum. Do I pronounce that correct?
Yes, Interregnum.
Exactly. Interregnum, there we go.
Yeah. Months ago, yeah.
That was it was great, by the way, after in the wake of the Swedish election. So
we
had a great conversation with you, Dan, and I really wanted to get you on the show and kind of talk about your own work and research a little bit. We're definitely going to talk about Arctos, but since you're located in Italy as well, we have to talk about Salvini, what's happening there with the migrant crisis and everything else. But before we get there, just share with us a few words about yourself, if you want to, whatever you want to let the audience know about yourself, and tell us how you ended up working with Arctos as well.
All right, very good. So anyway, I'm American, clearly, as my accent well betrays. I'm from Idaho in the United States originally, and traveled around in the States for quite some time before deciding to get over here to Europe, because I've always been very curious of Europe and felt drawn here for a number of different reasons. So about 8 years ago, I made my way over to Italy with, you know, various excuses like teaching English and, you know, wanting to see the world and all of that, and ended up settling down here. So now I live in Sardinia, which is one of the it's an island in the Mediterranean. It's one of the least affected parts of the country as far as immigration goes, and yet the effects here can also they can readily be felt and seen on a daily basis. Apart from that, I've been working for Arctos now for about a year and a half thereabouts. And I found Arctos sometime a few years ago. Actually, it was around the Trump elections that I began exploring Arctos. And I actually applied to be a volunteer here. And that's how I ended up in my present position through, obviously, you know, the regular steps. And right. So Arctos, just to say a couple of words about Arctos. Arctos is a publishing house which dedicates itself to traditionalist New Right literature. It is the world's premier publisher of New Right literature, European New Right literature in English, featuring works from Alain de Benoist, Guillaume Fay. Alexander Dugin is another one of our major authors. Arctos is a publishing house which is dedicated to proposing alternative views of the world, alternative visions of the world, alternatives in particular to the globalistic, egalitarian forms of politics and social ordering which are presently taking their place in our societies. We don't subscribe to any particular ideology or any particular way of looking at things. We consider ourselves a platform and a forum for presenting new novel ideas, which might give some indication of a way forward and a way of escaping from and dealing with some of the major problems and issues which are confronting our societies today.
What else can you say about the site? You guys have a journal there. Obviously, you do a podcast and things like this, too, beyond just the book publishing, of course, which is the main kind of oomph of what you guys do.
Yes, exactly. Our major activity is as a publisher, but we do have a journal, which began in August of last year. We publish, on average, 3 articles a week. These are articles which are dedicated to very much similar themes, similar ideas, and similar perspectives to those that we publish. We also have Interregnum, which is our official Arctos podcast. And in Interregnum, you'll have the opportunity to listen to conversations and interviews with some of our authors. We also tend to bring in other, you know, interesting voices. As Henrik noted, he was on himself not so very long ago.
Exactly.
And again, here the idea is simply to try to give voice to the concerns of our generation and to try to present alternatives to a very, very complicated world, which in many ways is, in the opinion of many interesting thinkers today, going very much wrong. So,
Absolutely. And you, of course, you guys, worth mentioning too, as it's, as you say, it's not only politics, it's obviously metapolitical, but even the spiritual aspect, which I think is really important. It's exploration, if you will, of even esoteric themes and things like this. And of course, I, you know, those familiar with Red Eyes many years ago, we were into a lot of those kinds of topics as well. Maybe not kind of more right-leaning, if you will, but still that deeper kind of quest for the deeper important questions is there, as well as an undertone in the work, which I think is important.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for mentioning that. Yes, we publish works, for example, by Julius Evola, but also by a number of other thinkers who try to explore that realm of existence, that kind of transcendent realm of existence. And again, this is part of our general mission, which is to present books, to present authors, to present ideas that go kind of beyond the discourse in which we're all trapped right now, through the media, through just kind of, you know, the natural state of society, as they kind of end up getting locked into particular ways of talking about things. And it's our objective to provide ground, provide space for authors and for thinkers and for ideas that move beyond that and give us the opportunity to see these things from outside. So obviously that definitely includes a spiritual element with many of our thinkers, many of our authors. Many of them are dedicated to kind of a political analysis. Many of them are dedicated to a social or cultural analysis. We try to offer opportunities to people to come at these questions from many, many different perspectives.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. Let's talk a bit about what's happening in Italy then, since you're familiar kind of more with the situation there. Sardinia, which is interesting. I thought that would actually be one of the islands that were hit hard by the migrant invasion, if you will. But it's more Sicily, maybe, more so than Sardinia?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sicily and the southern part of Italy have been hit more, and the reason for that is simply a geographical concern. Sardinia is too far away from the mainland. Most of the immigrants who come into Europe are coming into Europe with the intent of moving beyond. Beyond that, there's also simply a question of the sea routes which are used. Since most of these immigrants right now are coming through Libya, since the collapse of the Gaddafi regime, the enforced collapse of the Gaddafi regime, they tend to catch taxi boats, which are, you know, right down. Yeah, there we are. So this would be exactly. So right now the map is on Sardinia. And if you look a little bit south now, there's kind of a jutting projection out of Africa. And at the base of that, farther down yet, exactly. This kind of ocean area is this kind of sea area is where most of the boats are. So practically what happens is these immigrants gather on the coast of Africa. They find essentially people smugglers at this point. I mean, these people provide them with very, very shoddy watercraft boats.
It's human traffickers. Let's be honest about it.
They're human traffickers. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And we owe it actually to Salvini, among others here in Italy, that we've begun to speak of them in those terms rather than talking about them in terms of, you know, non-governmental organizations or things of this kind.
Yeah.
But the initial step for these people is to get onto boats that are not seaworthy. These boats are made to fall apart within several kilometers of the coast. And in defiance of practically all international regulations, the so-called non-governmental organizations, these boats of these people who are funded by the likes of George Soros, for example, go well out of their way, well out of any kind of route that could possibly be excused. And they go all the way down to the Libyan coast to fetch these people up out of the water and to bring them up north. And this obviously completely neglecting the several ports of entry that they could actually go to and should legally, they are legally bound to go to by international law. They ignore these ports in order to bring these people either to Malta or to Italy. But recently Malta, as of last year, actually Malta has begun to refuse to accept these people. And so they end up going to, you know, there's Malta there, the
And that's it's a sovereign, Malta is interesting, right? Because they do have the sovereign military order. It's tied to the Vatican and Rome, obviously, but it's like a micro state, right? Essentially.
Yes, exactly right. It's also interesting for a number of other reasons. They are trilingual, essentially. They speak their own kind of dialect, which is a mix of European languages and Arabic. And then they also speak English and Italian. And so these boats are brought north, and you can see from the map here that it would not make a great deal of sense for most of these people to be disembarking in Sardinia because Sicily is much nearer to where it is they actually
that's
get
right.
on the boats.
Yep.
So that's one of the reasons that we're protected here compared to Sicily, which ends up taking the brunt of the immigration. And in fact, Sicily has been the port of entry for migration into Europe since effectively since Hungary closed its borders and since Germany began to, you know, work with Turkey to do the same. So.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And let's just put that in context for a little bit, right? Because people need to remember and be reminded what happened to Gaddafi and the people behind it as well. Let's just play the clip. Let's go to Hillary Clinton, and this is what she said in the wake of invading Libya and taking care of Gaddafi.
Can never play this one too often.
No.
Yes, we came. We saw. He died.
Right.
Did it have anything to do?
There we go. So they took. You guys have all seen it, but they took him out. He was murdered by, I don't know what to call them, rebel forces or whatever, the funded side of the U.S. and the West essentially. He was brutally tortured and beaten and then killed. And look at what happened. Look at how the hell broke loose after that point, John. And the fact that we
yes,
were
indeed.
Told that this was a humanitarian effort, right? We have to save the people of Libya, blah, 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 all
it's
this
like
bullshit.
A democracy.
It's nauseating.
It really is nauseating. I mean, all of this. And the interesting thing about this is Gaddafi actually predicted what would happen in the case of his fall. I mean, he essentially stated, as was well known in the Italian government at that time, that he was the single barrier standing between essentially millions of dispossessed Africans flooding into Europe and you know, the borders of Europe. He was the only thing standing between them. And, you know, he came crashing down, and the result has been the migrant crisis. The migrant crisis is owed to essentially two things: the chaos in Syria, which has caused most of the migration, which has come mainland, and then the fall of the Gaddafi regime, which has brought the African immigrants. Most of the immigrants who come in through Italy are actually from Africa. They're not involved in the Syrian chaos.
Here's some footage of Gaddafi. It looks like it's shot with a potato. I don't know how they can get this bad resolution, but whatever. This is what it is. A bunch of people just surrounded him and they took him out. And as you say, he was the barrier. He was talking about the fact if we don't have, like, again, the function of a strong leader, a to a certain extent dictator, if you want to put it that way, but he held the forces at bay and people in check to prevent from what now is happening. And that's why, of course, the globalists needed to have him removed, right, to allow the invasion. It's planned. It was a planned event. And when the borders were like, or with a signal, as I should say, was declared, like, okay, now you can go. It's open now. I mean, what happened, if you think about it, all this time previously, you know, we have been able to keep these forces at bay in Europe and we had functioning borders. All of a sudden, it is like it's not there and we can't do anything about it. It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Exactly right, yeah. And there have actually been attempts since then to try to establish a kind of Gaddafi-like figure in Libya, one who is capable of regaining control over the Libyan situation in such a way that, you know, they can actually at least to some extent stem the flood that's coming from Africa, this human flood. I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, I mean, when we talk about Gaddafi in these terms, it sounds almost as if he was providing some kind of, you know, a shield and possibly even violently repelling people from coming through. But the fact of the matter is that when Gaddafi was in power, there was not the kind of continual stream of humanity from Africa to Libya that we see now, because it was known that nobody could get through Libya. People have lost their lives. Innocent immigrants, as the leftists like to call them. These innocent immigrants have lost their lives in the Mediterranean Sea because Gaddafi is no longer there. He's no longer providing this kind of barrier. And these people come, they get on boats that are made to sink. And thousands of them have died in the Mediterranean. So, I mean, even from the kind of general humanitarian standpoint of somebody who genuinely cares about the fate of these Africans, the absence of Gaddafi right now has caused many, many more deaths than his presence did.
Absolutely. And, of course, we know about the maps and things, like some of the, I think it was Sky News that found maps and directions and go here to basically those who are seeking to migrate to Europe from Middle East and North Africa. So it's like a, there's NGOs down there. They're providing them with details. Of course, the ships, we don't even have to talk about that. Thankfully, Aquarius, by the way, which one of the was Doctors Without Borders, that one was actually decommissioned recently where they had to stop their activities, mainly due to Salvini, as far as I understand it.
That's right, because it was flying a flag that had nothing to do with it. I can't remember exactly the details. I think it might have been a Dutch flag that it was flying, when in fact it's not a Dutch vessel. And this is, again, this is against international regulations. It's against the law of the sea, and in consequence, it had to be decommissioned.
Yeah, well, then you see, then it's rules all of a sudden, right? They can break the rules.
Yes, exactly.
Otherwise, they can say, well, according to law, we're not, if we find, what do you call it? I almost said stranded, but that's not the maritime term for it, right? They're out in the ocean.
Shipwrecked. Yeah,
is that what you call it? Yeah, shipwrecked. If you see a ship like that, then you have to pick it up according to maritime law, right? You're not allowed to, like, just leave and say,
yes,
oh, that's it.
This is really one of the aspects of this, which I think really deserves to be dwelt on a little bit, because essentially what's happening here is these people are using the laws in order to produce a kind of taxi service for African immigrants into Europe. They're using laws which exist for clear and legitimate reasons, but they've found ways of manipulating these laws. They found loopholes in these laws, or for example, the one that you stated. It's known that any vessel in the sea that comes across a shipwreck is quite beyond being morally bound to save the shipwreck survivors, is also legally bound to do so by international law. Now, this has led to the practice that I was describing earlier, where these people are put on vessels that they're essentially like banana boats thrust out into the Mediterranean Sea. It is known that these vessels will sink. And so they're producing a situation in which these non-governmental organizations have a clear legal pretext for picking these individuals up. Completely contrary to the purposes of these law, because in fact, they're actually endangering a great many more people than they're saving this way. But nonetheless, this is just one instance of the many, many steps along the way in which they've actually found a way of using laws with very good reasons in order to produce a constant influx into Europe of people who are destined to immediately just kind of become homeless beggars wandering in the streets, which obviously has consequences for crime. It has consequences for social order. It has any number of consequences.
Yeah, there's so many things that comes in the wake of that. Some, as you say, sometimes they go lawless. They kind of disappear. They are entering into the country. But the only way for them to take care of themselves economically is to begin to sell drugs and prostitution and all these kinds of, you know, black market activities or whatever, illegal activities. The other side to that is, of course, that people are can get help, assistance from the state that they enter into. And so in many cases, they enter in with, let's say, no papers one time. They exit out and go in again under a different name, a different paper. Or again, they can claim they just don't have any or whatever. Oh, I'm at war. I'm Syrian, whatever. They can say that they're underage. It's just like a massive industry of scam, basically, that we're getting
a
lot of these people.
And, you know, I mean, as an immigrant into Italy, obviously, I have to go through much of the same steps that, you know, an African immigrant has to go through in order to maintain my visa status, et cetera, et cetera. And when I go into the police station to do this, I'm confronted with a situation in which, you know, there are a great many people in there who are attempting to get their visas either given to them for the first time or renewed. And the situations that I encounter there, just the few times that I have to go in, they're shocking. I mean, these are people who have literally printed out filled forms from that they found on the internet, and they're attempting to get through with these documents. There's absolutely no way of checking these people. I mean, there are images online. I actually should have found one of these for you, Henrik, but didn't think of it. But there are images online of the kind of holding centers for the immigrants here who have been actually rejected by the political establishment. These are people who have requested asylum and have had their asylum requests rejected. And so there's a place where they go waiting to be deported, and that's a very long process. They're there for a very, very long time. And the fences around these things are essentially just, you know, playground fences. There are images of people just jumping over them and leaving. I mean, the fact of the matter is that all of this happened with an incredible rapidity. And Italy was not prepared in any way to deal with any of this situation. It was not prepared from the financial point of view. It was not prepared from the point of view of having the right institutions, the right laws in place, the right infrastructure. And the consequence has been that many of these people, a good percentage of these people, as you said, simply vanish. They vanish into Europe. No one has any idea how many of them there are. There is no way of documenting them. There is no way of knowing where they come from, why they're here. It's a completely incredible situation, and it's a situation that no sovereign state should have to confront, which is, you know, where we come to the present question of, you know, Salvini has been essentially, you know, accused in a, well, obviously he's been accused of this, but there's actually a trial which is being brought against him, or they're trying to get brought against him, which would hold him guilty for kidnapping people on one of the boats that was brought into shore here.
Like, the NGOs and the boats that are literally kidnapping people, shipping them into, you know, Europe.
Exactly. It's a completely outrageous claim. He's being accused of abusing his office, of abduction, personal abduction. A number of other charges are being brought against him, all along similar lines. Mm. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, he's the prime minister of the interior. His job is to protect the borders, among other things. The fact that legally speaking, there's a question that he might not be able to even secure the borders of Italy is really shocking when you think about it. And he's pointed this out in many of his videos and many of the things that he's written in the response to this entire charade that,
Why don't we play that, actually, before you go on? Let's just listen to that. I have about 4 minutes of it. We played it in Weekend Warrior here, actually, last week, the show before. But check this out, guys, if you haven't seen it.
Right, so just a bit of background on this, because I think it might be useful. This is Salvini's Facebook account of the moment that he received the document which brought these charges against him. So this is actually the first time that this news hit the airwaves, essentially.
Yeah, it's
and so he's discussing
live,
the document, right? and he's discussing what's happened with it. So, and then we can talk more about exactly what did happen.
Certainly, let's listen here.
Pena prevista per il senatore Matteo Salvini momentaneamente ministro dell'interno, da 3 a 15 anni di galera, manco fossi uno spacciatore o uno stupratore. Perché? Perché osai, secondo questi 3 giudici del Tribunale di Catania, bloccare lo sbarco quest'estate dei 177 immigrati presenti sulla nave Diciotti. Allora, capiamoci, se uno fa il ministro, applica la legge, articolo 52 della Costituzione italiana, la difesa della patria è sacro dovere del cittadino, soprattutto se il cittadino è pure ministro. La difesa dei confini, la difesa delle regole, la difesa del vivere civile, la difesa della democrazia, per qualcuno no. Per qualcuno un ministro che blocca gli sbarchi non difende la patria, ma deve finire in galera. Chiarisco subito, io non cambio di un centimetro la mia posizione. Barche, barchini e barconi, di scafisti, trafficanti, mafiosi o amici di tizio, ONG, olandesi e tedesche, in Italia non sbarcano nessuno. Quindi se sono stato sequestratore una volta, ritenetemi sequestratore anche per i mesi a venire. Non cambio assolutamente idea perché voglio salvare vite e voglio presidiare i confini e voglio difendere il mio paese. In ordine al reato di sequestro di persona aggravato. Aspetta, È vero, non è uno scherzo. Non siamo su Scherzi a parte, non siamo su lercio.it, siamo in Italia. Sequestro di persona aggravato. Ecco, io. Wanted. Secondo questi 3 signori del Tribunale di Catania, io avrei abusato dei miei poteri e privato della libertà personale 177 migranti di varie nazionalità giunti al porto di Catania a bordo dell'unità navale di soccorso Diciotti, bloccava la procedura di sbarco dei migranti. Sì, lo rivendico, lo confesso, lo ammetto, ho bloccato la procedura di sbarco dei migranti. Se questa è una colpa, se questo è un reato, sono colpevole di questo reato, nel senso che barche, barchini e barconi, in Italia il loro carico di esseri umani, che per gli scafisti diventano soldi con cui comprano armi e droga, in Italia un porto non ce l'hanno. Preparatevi a compilare altri atti, non so, da 15 anni arriverò a 30 anni, a 45 anni, all'ergastolo, sono pronto all'ergastolo perché ho bloccato e ribloccherò la procedura di sbarco dei migranti. Quindi sono un sequestratore vile, vigliacco, infamo, fascista, razzista, ma pure di bambini. Cioè non sequestro solo gli adulti, ma sequestro pure i bambini. Lasciamo che l'immigrazione sia gestita dall'ONU, dalle ONG, pigliate qua uno scafista, gli fate fare il ministro, così lui non sequestra nessuno. Le politiche sull'immigrazione, le politiche dell'antiterrorismo, le politiche sulla sicurezza le decide il governo, non le decidono dei privati olandesi. Andate in Olanda, andate in Germania, andate in Francia, andate a Malta, andate dove volete, in Italia no. Come voteranno tutti gli altri senatori, se ci sarà una maggioranza in Senato che dice sì, Salvini è colpevole. Salvini deve essere processato, Salvini deve essere incarcerato perché ha abusato, ha sequestrato, ha trattenuto, è un delinquente. Lo confesso, non c'è neanche bisogno del processo, l'ho fatto e lo rifarò, perché questo non è un mio diritto, ma ritengo sia un mio dovere. La difesa dei confini e la difesa della sicurezza dei cittadini italiani per me vengono prima di tutto e di tutti. Bacioni.
Yeah, I mean, this is, he's absolutely correct, standing his ground, admitting to what he's doing, because yes. This is his job. He's supposed to do this.
Exactly.
But we could break it down and talk about the different aspects of this, but it's very interesting because I would assume that these judges are not elected individuals, right? They've been educated and they got the job somehow, right? Why are they doing this? How can they do this?
Well, I mean, they can do this in the same way that they can do it, trials against any individual, any public or private individual in any country. There are some grounds that are legitimate enough to bring charges against him, insofar as it's easy to understand how a number of the laws that are on the books might indicate that somebody who is attempting to stop a boatload of, you know, shipwrecked individuals who were at the mercy of the sea from coming onto dry land and receiving medical aid, et cetera, how this could be a crime. One can understand that. But again, this is another case of where the law is being used in a completely inappropriate and illicit way, in abuse of its original purpose, in order to bring lawfare, essentially, against a very important personage in this case, and somebody who's doing a great deal of good, not only for Italy, but also for Europe. But the three judges in question all pertain to the Magistratura Democratica, which is the democratic magistrature. This is known to be kind of the left-wing part of the judiciary in Italy. Berlusconi used to rail against these people because they brought all kinds of legal actions against him. And there again, you know, that's an entirely different story. Many of those were probably justified in the end. But nonetheless, it's known that these people have certain leftist tendencies. These are people with an ideological agenda. The situation in Italy is not quite what it is in the United States, as a way of comparison. In the United States, it's understood, although this is obviously not generally true, it's understood that judges, ideally speaking, should be in a way super partes. They should be without any kind of political affiliation. They should, you know, they owe their final fidelity and loyalty and regard to the Constitution instead of to a political party. In Italy, things are not quite that cut and dry. The Constitution is the ruling law of the land, as in the United States, but let's put it, the judiciary is somewhat clearer in its political stance, and it's understood that these are judges of the left. So, I mean, the consequences of that, we will see. At present, though, it should be pointed out this is not going to trial as of yet. Right now, right. The next step, this has to be brought before the Italian Senate, and they will vote on whether or not this will actually see a court of law.
Yeah. Do you think it will? What's the temperature like?
This is the interesting question. This is the question of the day. It's clear that what's called the center-right in Italy is going to vote against sending this on to court. They do not have a majority, however. The left is clearly going to vote to send it to court. They're very much in the minority. The question right now is what the Movimento Cinque Stelle, the five-star movement, is going to do. And they're in a very, very interesting situation, as they have been since the beginning of this government. They are caught essentially between two different worlds because they rode to power essentially – in an alliance with Salvini. They never would have arrived without that alliance, just as Salvini would not have arrived without the alliance with them. But they pertain to two completely different political worlds. There is very, very little in common between the League, Salvini's political party, and the Five Star Movement. The Five Star Movement is very much a populist movement, and it has kind of this eclectic and very difficult to pin down a platform which shifts left and right on any number of very important issues. Salvini is extremely clear, as I think that video clip shows. That's a very good characterization of him. He has extremely set ideas. He is forthright. He is not afraid of anyone. And he, you know, this is one of the things that just cannot help but delight about Salvini and refresh about him.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are, you know, there are many reasons to have some hesitations about a Salvini in office, but in our present time, I can't imagine anybody better for the job. The Five Star Movement is not like that. The Five Star Movement is rather wishy-washy, kind of jumps from left to right, and they have to decide what they're going to do with this question. On the one hand, the Five Star Movement has been very, very heavy on attempting to insist on the fact that people in public, public officials essentially have to be held responsible for their actions. This is very important in Italy because the political class in Italy is rotten to the core, essentially.
Yeah.
And so, on the other hand, you know, I mean, they're part of the coalition with Salvini, and so it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. And at the present, it's impossible to say. It's just impossible even to try to predict what they're going to do. I imagine they're going to be split down the middle, and I'm not sure which way it's going to fall.
Might be a close call then. And then
it could be
goes
a close call.
To trial, and I mean, I think it's frivolous for this aspect that he should be able to use the laws on his side. He's doing his job, which he's meant to do, right? But it's always an interpretation, and but it has to be argued. I think it's a good case also. Should we say first, they want him gone, right? They don't want him.
As a European
leader, he is a big threat. There's papers writing about him all over Europe. The European elite doesn't like him. Macron doesn't like him. There's a number of people. And he met with Orban not too long ago, right, from Hungary. So there is these clear groupings that are starting to occur now within European politics, where we have these blocs working against. And it's basically globalism versus nationalism. That's how simple it is, right?
Yes, that's really what it comes down to. And that brings a lot of complications with it as well, because the nationalist position is obviously, in a certain sense, internally divided, because what is good for one nation is not necessarily good for another nation, et cetera, whereas the globalist position tends to be rather, monolithic and centralized. This is one of the tasks that's confronting the nationalists today, is to try to find some kind of common ground from which they can work and a way of, you know, uniting amongst themselves, despite the fact that they probably will not agree on everything and they will have different styles of leadership, et cetera, et cetera. Salvini has really, in many ways, laid the groundwork for something like this, though. And I think it's definitely not an exaggeration to say that the advent of Salvini in Italian politics is the worst thing that's happened to the European Union globalists since Brexit, and might even be worse than Brexit, since we're seeing that Brexit is kind of, you know, mired down in all kinds of bureaucratic technicalities, whereas Salvini, as can be seen, just sort of barrels right through these things, and it's exactly what we need right now.
But absolutely, yep. Someone who's not afraid.
He's a huge threat.
And again, he's if they send him to jail, it will be. We can use that too. Let me put it that way, right? I mean, in terms of like how disgusting these globalists are, and the way that they're like. It's clear what the agenda is, and the agenda is to just flood Europe with migrants. It's the Kalergi plan, if you want to call it that, for simplicity's sake. There are nuances within this, but just as a way of communicating that idea to the people, that the European elites, they basically do not want different homogenous nations within Europe. They want to have a mixed population, not only of Europeans, but of mixed into that Middle Easterners, Africans, etc., as an effort, of course, to try to destroy that which unifies the nation state, and that's the people, right? So eradicate the people, in a sense, not eradicate, but blend them up. Then you will lose eventually over time a dedication to the nation, because there's no common bonds there, right?
Right. I mean, this is described in a number of different ways. It's been called the Great Replacement. It's been called, white genocide. There are all kinds of terms that are used to describe this. I think actually many of the terms that attempt to get at this are not entirely accurate, because the point of this is not to eliminate any kind of ethnicity. The point of this is to eradicate people culturally. The point of this, I mean, it's not as if they want to bring in Africans and make Europe into Africa. They want to completely destroy the possibility of any kind of uprising on the local level, which means that they've got to detach people from the land, where they're born. They've got to find a way of disconnecting people from their local cultures, from their customs, from their ways, from all of the things that they inherit from their grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. And the best way of doing this is to mix them together with people from radically different countries who were brought in, who are themselves deracinated and lost. And to mix all of these people together so that none of them has any way of rooting in a particular nation, rooting in a particular city or a particular region. The consequence of this, obviously, is that people become essentially consumers. I mean, they lose their identity altogether. They have to find some way of attempting to, reconstitute it. And the simplest way of doing so is to turn to the market and to try to buy their way back into humanity. But people become cogs in a machine. They go to work to make money so that they can purchase, and that's it. That's the end of human existence, essentially. And this, obviously, for the profit of these extraordinarily wealthy individuals who are presently running the system. It is an appalling thing that's happening, and it's happening under such flowery and beautiful language like human rights and equality
tolerance.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's done with multiple excuses here, as in every other country of Europe, and as it happens in the United States as well. It's done under all kinds of, excuses. It's said that these people have to come in and replace a failing population so that they can pay everybody's pensions and retirement funds and things
like
that.
Yeah, that's happening.
And it's a bad joke. You go in the streets and these people are digging out of dumpsters, something that, you never was seen before they came. It's just, it's incredible.
And of course, it's done with total disregard for the individuals already in the country, right? And the future of those children that are there to inherit that nation. Because it needs to be pointed out, too, that with this aspect, and I would not have been for it even if these people came in legally. I would not have been for it even if these people were the best individuals in the world and they could help us every. I don't want it. I don't care. Even if my population in Sweden or Europe in the extension sucked as a group, right, as a people, and they couldn't do any of these things that we've seen that they have been able to do historically, achieve these kinds of issues, I would still not be for it. I would be opposed to that. So it should be said, though, that with this move that the globalist makes of importing individuals, which we don't know who they are, there's no checks, there's no registration of these individuals, and even if there is, they can give a wrong name, etc., right? We are literally playing Russian roulette with the individuals, with our children and everyone's life in these countries, because we don't know if there are mental cases. We don't know if they're ISIS terrorists. We don't know if there's any kind of faction or group that is violent or hateful or anything like that. And as we've seen, there's been plenty in Sweden and Europe, the UK, France, and other places as well, where some of these individuals that have entered in under false premises have flipped or snapped, or they have gone on a killing spree. And the fact that this is not connected, where people are saying, well, it's clear that we don't know who's coming in, and some of them are flipping out. There might be some good people among the bunch. Sure, great. But who cares at the end of the day? It's the dangerous ones that we need to think about primarily and say, we are, how do I put this? We are prioritizing the lives of these individuals over our own children, John. And risking the potentiality that they will be murdered or killed or run over or stabbed or something like this so that we can take care of them. It's insanity to me.
It's excellently said, Henrik. I mean, you've really put your finger on it. We haven't even touched on the question of terrorism, the question of ISIS, the fact that many of these individuals might be coming over with the premeditated intent to commit a terrorist action. And there's simply no way of evaluating this because there are not sufficient checks in place, and there cannot be with the numbers of individuals that we're seeing coming over, or that we were seeing coming over, because it should also be pointed out that although on average, Italy has been netting anywhere between 150,000 to 250,000 of these individuals every year. The arrival of immigrants in Italy in 2019 has diminished by over 95%, thanks to Salvini. You know, this is very, very good news, and it's evidence of the fact that he's doing exactly what he should be doing. Before he came into office, it was said that it couldn't be done. Everyone said that you can't stop immigration, but he has proved otherwise, exactly as Orbán did in Hungary. Now, the question of terrorism, which you bring, which you shed light on, I think is absolutely essential here. This is a question, I mean, in the most obvious way, it's a question of dangerous individuals who are on these boats who come into European countries with the intent of killing Europeans. We know that there are individuals like this because there have been cases of these people who have done exactly that. They've done precisely that. But even beyond that, part of the problem here is that many of the terrorists who have acted on European soil are not immigrants just arrived from off the boats. These are, you know, immigrants of the second and third generation. We are establishing enclaves of non-Europeans within Europe in which any kind of radicalism, any kind of terroristic intent, any kind of, from the standpoint of Europe, absolutely outlandish and bizarre ideas about the way that society should be run. These things can be cultivated in these places. These places become kinds of feeding beds for them. And we've seen the consequences of this in terms of European dead. I mean, we've seen people murdered essentially for this error precisely.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that in the immigration flows have been brought to such a halt in Italy cannot help but be regarded as a good thing from anyone who's concerned, as you said, with our European heritage, our European children. I mean, to look at it any other way is really kind of – it's striking also in terms of how effectively the people who have attempted to pull this over on us have been able to manipulate the press and manipulate the information which comes to the populations of European countries. Mm-hmm. Because obviously they would never have been able to do this without at least a kind of tacit or passive support on the part of European citizens. And that simply attests to their ability to turn these stories around and to spin them in a way. Right, exactly. I mean, showing images like the one that you're showing right now, Henrik, the fact of the matter is that the immigrants, you know, they're very often targeted by certain parts of the right as being kind of, you know, the biggest threat to us. They're not the biggest threat. Many of these immigrants really are simply, you know, as the cliche has it, they're looking for a better life. The ridiculous thing about it is that they are lied to about this. I mean, they're given false information about what to expect on European shores. They're given this idea, this impression. In many cases, they're outright told that they will come here, they will find a job, and they will be able to send money back to their families in Africa, as many prior immigrants did in times when it was still possible. They arrive here with that expectation, and they end up on the streets. I mean, the idea that this is going to produce anything other than a kind of resentful, dissatisfied, poor underclass, which is capable essentially of anything, is absolutely appalling. I mean, it's ridiculous to think.
Yeah,
that
definitely.
Else could
I mean, they are economic opportunists. They do seek, as you say, a better life. And at the end of it, it isn't the individual's fault in all of this too. And I think that's our critics. They don't make this mistake. They make this intentionally to make us seem as bad individuals.
Yes.
For refusing or not wanting to have these individuals. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what we are talking about is not that we want individuals to go out on the street and target individual migrants. I don't know anybody that has ever said something
no
like
one.
That.
No one.
What we talk about is a policy change, right? It should be brought to a vote. It should be we should have a say in this. We should be able to discuss and influence the discourse about this. We awaken people's open people's eyes to what it is that's happening and why the establishment are doing these kinds of things, right? So it's a very different way that we're approaching the problem. At the end of this, though, sure, I'm definitely for some kind of remigration repatriation program.
Absolutely.
And in some cases, there's many countries doing this. Finland right now is offering migrants and asylum seekers, I think, €5,000? I forget the article now. They upped it. It was like 2,500 previously, I think. Now they're offering them $5,000 to give them an economic incentive to leave, which I think is a bit much better option, to be honest, than having them living on a life of dependency within our countries, never fitting in, feeling outside as an outsider. And we know that those conditions too, by the way, John, is actually those that lead individuals in Europe to seek out organizations and institutions which makes them feel more rooted than ever. In other words, extreme organizations such as ISIS and such are actually very attractive to especially young boys, young men, because they feel so out of place. And the only thing they know what to do is to reach for the most Islamic or, you know, whatever you want to dub it, like organization they can think of in many regards. In other words, the very environment that we bring them into and create for them is causing many to go seek out extremism, if you see what I'm saying.
An excellent point. And I think it's a natural and inescapable consequence of attempting to deracinate human beings. The moment that you cut their roots out from underneath them, they will seek that somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I mean, say what you will about the Islamic jihadists or even Islam in general. They do have a kind of belief in a sort of transcendent realm. They have a belief in a deity. They have a belief in a morality that is largely, by and large, is lacking in Europe today. It's normal for people to you know, seek this out, particularly if they feel in any way lost, particularly if it happens, you know, they happen to be that young man who just couldn't get a job, right? Who wasn't able to, you know, purchase his way into humanity, as these people want to make us do. But quite beyond that, people who are interested in a kind of deeper existence, people who are interested in attempting to live in a more real way, in a more authentic way, if they turn to the institutions that have historically provided this within European countries, and they find that all of those institutions have been hollowed out and emptied and essentially do not fulfill that role, they will look for it elsewhere. And right now, the clearest place that they can find that in many, many cases is essentially Islam. I mean, it's the Muslims provide that in a way that certainly many European Christians cannot, and in a way that many European nations cannot more generally.
Now, do you think that's is there anybody at any level of those who are promoting this that have a kind of a realization of this or an awareness of this, do you think? Because I remember for a while I was talking about this issue that terrorism seems to be kind of an artificial unifying aspect. I know that might sound strange, but hear me out. What we've seen in the wake of terrorist acts, John, is that we've seen kind of a false unity, like it's almost working as a kind of a glue where everyone, no matter where they're from or whatever, can come out and unify under this umbrella. We all don't like extremism, right? Just ignore that the very issues of the conditions we create actually create extremists, etc. What I'm saying is that it works, it has a function in society where it's very difficult to unify these people or have something that bonds them together. But to a certain extent, they can bond over the issue that they're against the mass slaughter of individuals, right? So there's, and I don't know how, what level of intentional, I should say, if they know this on some level, if there's some psychologist here who understands that actually, you know what, it's good, we can use this, or if it's just a kind of a sad side effect to this the policy that these EU politicians have been running.
That's a very good question, Henrik. I mean, I think that one thing that the left, and I mean, when I say left, I mean this in a very, very general way. I don't simply mean, obviously, the Democratic Party in the United States or the PD here in Italy. I mean this in a much, much more general way to include kind of those people who are interested in sort of, you know, social justice and egalitarianism and liberalizing states and things like this. The left has been very, very, very good at taking advantage of situations. And unfortunately, they kind of arise spontaneously in consequence of what they do. And unfortunately, I think that the globalistic contingent of the left, which actually is not at all interested in any of these kinds of rather idealistic ideas like egalitarianism or liberalism, and really do want to just kind of assert their raw rule over European states, the globalistic contingent has been able to take advantage of any number of what were probably originally unexpected consequences of the immigration flow, as, for example, terrorism. The more terrorism that happens on European shores, the more laws can be established against hate, for example,
yes.
Which work, you know, quite contrary to, you know, any kind of purported intent that they might have. They don't work toward stopping terrorists from massacring innocent individuals in Christmas markets. They work against nationalists. They work against people who are trying to stop the situation from unfolding to begin with. And I think that seeing that kind of advantage of, you know, what doesn't seem to have, it seems to be a situation with any advantages whatsoever. They found a way of turning it to their advantage. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is a certain sense in which they actually, some of them actually are kind of hoping to cultivate this advantage, perhaps even by, you know, bringing in more terrorists or something along these lines. Obviously, they're not the ones that have to worry about it. I mean, they and their families are quite safe from any of the kinds of bad consequences.
Well think of it. That's a very important point and an interesting point, too, because think of it this way. After the Second World War, right, you had things like, and this came out of Italy, Operation Gladio, right, the Stay Behind Network. It was actually a way for that's called the deep state for simplicity's sake. Created far-right individuals, terrorists, ensure that they were able to do these things of trying to create a terror network, which would, again, both unify but also aid in the process of creating laws, more security, more militarization of police, etc. There is a function in the build-up. Now, if they can do this with migrants, they bring them in. And again, from their point of view, a fortunate side effect is that some of them turn to terrorism. They can effectively use that as a the foundation for why we should have our laws reformed. Why should we should have more spying on everybody, more surveillance, basically creating a kind of a control grid, right? So it benefits them on so many different levels. It's too good to be true, right?
Yes, exactly. And again, this is just another instance of the way that they are able to respond to events as they unfold. And I mean, this is something I think we should actually be learning from them. There's a tendency, I think, in nationalism generally, I think this is a tendency definitely in many strains of the right, to stand on principle, which is a fantastic thing, and it's something that we have to do. But this kind of standing on principle becomes so hard-headed and so stubborn that there's not even a way in which we can kind of look at events as they unfold and respond to them on our feet. You know, we kind of see these things happen, and there's a reactionary tendency on the right. I mean, it's a very interesting term, this term reactionary. It's a term that developed actually in the French Revolution, and it was used as a pejorative against people who were not in line with the liberal revolution in France.
Yeah,
we have accepted it. I mean, many people on the right actually accept this term, which I find to be just fascinating. I mean, why would you be a reactionary?
It also reveals that you're just kind of in a, maybe not a defensive position, but as you say, a position where you don't lead or take an initiative to drive something. You just react to what someone else does, right? It's a passive term.
Exactly right. And I think it's actually not at all true. I mean, if you look at even conservatives, who are kind of the classical reactionaries, the really intent conservatives, these people are not simply reacting. I mean, they're moving from a place of love, essentially. There's something they want to preserve. They want to preserve their homeland, their ways of life. They want to preserve their languages, their customs, the things that they eat for dinner, their family structures, et cetera, et cetera. All of this is a very positive point of reference. They're not just reacting against things. I mean, they're trying actively and continually to perpetuate these things unto posterity. And so this term reactionary, you know, as a sort of metapolitical term applied to these people was a stroke of genius. I mean, essentially you've undercut them completely from their positive aspects, and you've reduced them to a sort of passive, but what were those toys? You remember those toys that used to kind of sit on the ground, and every time you hit them, they just sort of bounce back up again?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what they're called, but you know, that sort of thing. That's what they've been reduced to. And I think that we see this a lot in many parts of the West today. Conservatism has been undercut completely by this idea that the conservative does not actually have any sort of ideal that he's working toward. The conservative is simply just taking what happens and, you know, raging against it. And the consequence of this is that in many, many parts of Europe and in many parts of the United States, there's the perception of, you know, many young, intelligent people that there's nothing left that's worth conserving as it is. there actually has to be change now. But I mean, this just indicates the importance of a kind of active approach to these things, and an approach which is able to kind of run with unexpected advantages and come up with new ways of addressing situations, a kind of dynamic approach rather than simply a passive and reactionary approach.
Absolutely. And this is a very good point. And I think we should pick up this conversation here in part two. We have much more to discuss and talking a bit more about how they're seeking to both take down Salvini and how you see some of the solutions to this and raising awareness. There's many other things going on too, actually, in Sardinia that we want to talk about. There's a protest there by the farmers, the milk producers specifically. We've seen something similar in Sweden as well. Let's talk about that and much more when we come back. But tell us a bit more than just about Arctos, if there's any of the recent publications you want to mention, so people know where to go to kind of check out your work and of Arctos too.
Right. So absolutely. Anyone who's interested in Arctos can visit us at arctos.com, www.arctos.com. My work can be found there. I am a frequent contributor to our Arctos journal. Right. So actually right now, if you look, if you stop right there, Henrik, there are some of our most recent titles. These are all right. So the smaller squares represent our audiobooks. This is something that we began just last year. We have a series of audiobooks, which are obviously based on our publications. The three larger squares there are our most recent titles, starting from the left and going to the right. That's Excessive Immigration by Winston C. Banks. This is a very, very interesting level-headed approach to the immigration crisis in Britain in particular. What's noteworthy about this book is its complete lack of radicality. This book is simply viewing immigration from a commonsensical perspective and noting that immigration has certain problems, certain unexpected consequences, certain complications that it brings with it that should be addressed, that should be considered, and that above all should be talked about. Britain has become very, very close to these questions. It's very difficult to talk about these things openly. And this is for that reason, it's a very brave book, because notwithstanding the fact that it's actually, as I said, not at all radical, it's very commonsensical. Nonetheless, it's a very brave book because it brings into the light a number of questions that have become taboo, because the rate at which things are becoming taboo in the West is simply amazing.
Oh, yes.
So would definitely recommend that book, particularly for anyone who's interested in knowing what's happening in Britain. The next book is also by one of our English authors, The Uniqueness of Western Law, A Reactionary Manifesto, and this is by Richard Story. This is a defense of libertarianism from an ethnic point of view, an ethnic and a Christian point of view. And so it's a very unique take on libertarianism. We also had a very, very fine interview with Richard Story on our Interregnum. It's a podcast that anyone who's interested in the book can certainly go and visit. They can find it on our site. If you go to arctos.com, there's a part at the top where you can see the podcasts, and there you'll find our most recent podcast, which includes as well, there it is, The Uniqueness of Western Law with Richard Story. Very, very good interview, and a very interesting take again on libertarianism. Libertarianism, which is rooted in a long-standing Western European tradition, which goes all the way back to Christendom. Richard Story traces it back to Christendom and defends libertarianism on the basis as well of a defense of the kind of ethnic grounding of European states. And so obviously interesting for anyone who is curious about libertarianism or who wants to see libertarianism taken from a different angle. And then our other most recent publication is Alba Rosa. These are 10 traditionalist essays about the crisis in the modern West by Alexander Wolfhez. This is a book which considers the crisis in Europe from a rigorously traditionalist, that's traditionalist with a capital T, point of view. So this is a man who works in the tradition of men like René Guénon and Julius Evola, and is able to consider our present plight from that point of view. There are not many living authors who are able to do so with such a degree of depth. His grasp of history, of linguistics, of traditions is quite possibly unparalleled so far as I know. An incredibly deep book about the present situation in the West, so I strongly recommend that as well.
Interesting. Yeah, those are great. It's some titles there for people to enjoy and check out if you want to read more, whatever might interest you. Of course, there's hundreds of more books that you guys have that
people can look at through? As of the start of this year, we had 170 titles. We've added 3 to that already, so we're growing rapidly. And then here, just a couple things to point out. A Fair Hearing, the audiobook, is obviously also available as a book itself. A Fair Hearing is the alt-right in the words of its founders and members, and so this is a book which is dedicated to considering the alt-right from the perspective of the people who actually went to building it up, both practically and ideologically. So it's a very challenging work. Obviously, along the lines of the alt-right, so it's precisely what you'd expect to find. You know, very, very challenging in kind of an outrageous way at times, but, there are a lot of taboos that need to be shattered apart. And then the other audiobook that's available, that one of our recent audiobook releases, is The Real Right Returns by none other than Daniel Freeberg, the owner of Arctos, the founder of Arctos. And this is an excellent handbook for the reconstitution of a real right, a true right in our day. It is a very, very condensed, very streamlined, very, very clear, crystalline presentation of some of the principles that are absolutely necessary to reclaim the European states of today, to reclaim our nations, to reclaim our peoples. And so it's a work which is indispensable for anyone who is looking at this, present situation in Europe, exactly the sorts of things we've been discussing that have been happening in Italy, and how to go about actually changing things, how to go about, attempting to rectify a situation which has gone terribly wrong.
Absolutely. Well, great, great line of recent titles there, of course. So definitely check it out, folks. Arctos.com. We'll have all the links in the description down below, so definitely check it out. But yeah, we'll just take a short break here, then we're going to continue with part 2. Stay with us, John, and everybody. We'll be right back. Hey, join us for part 2 at redicemembers.com as we continue with John Bruce Leonard from Arctos, the editor-in-chief at Arctos, to continue to talk about the situation in Italy, and we'll expand our conversation as well in part 2. So check it out, redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership with us. Try it out for 3 months. You get a lot of exclusive material like Weekend Warrior, other videos, and of course, most of part 2 of the interview shows that we do all the way back to 2006. We have over 1,700 entries, I think, on the members' website. So a lot of things to dive into there for you as well. But yeah, thank you so much for considering that. Sign up, support us, make sure we can continue. We'll see you guys at redicemembers.com. We'll be right back.